Perhaps
Well,
you could start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself, because I think many Danes probably haven't heard of you. So a little
ah.
bit about your background.
Okay. Well, I'm a person who's a retired mechanical engineer. My most recent job in that regard was working for a company called the Coors Brewing Company, a place that makes beer, and one of their subsidiaries that made photovoltaic panels. So I come from an engineering background, and I come from that sort of way too logical, rational mindset that requires things to all be sort of left-brained and logical, which, as you know, Anya, it doesn't really fit too well with retrievals and exploring beyond physical reality and all that sort of thing. But I've had an interest there since childhood. That's just has followed me for years and years and years. And so as a kid, there were these three questions that I constantly thought about from age probably 5 years old. Where was I before I was here? And what am I supposed to do while I'm here? And where do I go when I leave here? And it was those three questions that eventually drove me to explore beyond this physical world to discover if there's something that's beyond it. Yeah. So that's kind of a quick thumbnail sketch. I live in a nice, sunny, warm climate here in Florida with my wife Farron and for right now my son Daniel.
And you published
Yeah.
five books.
Five books, yes. The first four are essentially a description of my own early explorations and how I learned to do this stuff in the first place. It follows the beginning of really wanting to know, but seriously doubting such a place existed, and really seriously doubting that I would have the ability to discover whether it was real or not. And follows that story in the first four books, past the point of convincing myself through my own direct experience of exploring beyond physical reality that there is such a place, and that some areas of that place are the places that we go after we die. They're also the same place that many of us are before we are born here. And the fifth book is a guidebook. I teach three different workshops, and the fifth book is called the Afterlife Knowledge Guidebook, and that one contains everything I've ever taught in my first workshop in a format that makes it easy for people to begin to explore and understand more deeply how to do that.
Great.
Yeah, is there more
No,
you'd like to hear
I
about
think
that?
that's a nice introduction.
Okay, good. And I'm sure you'll be able to edit this, so if I ramble on too long, you'll be able to say,
I
click.
don't think that'll be necessary.
Well, I'll talk to my wife, Farron. She'll tell you, Bruce cannot tell a
I
short
know
story.
that. I've been to your workshops.
Yeah.
Great. So I'll start with the questions that I collected from some friends and people I know.
Okay.
And I'll start with one from a friend of mine called Gitte, that I know is truly your field of expertise. So I thought, well,
Say that
I know
again.
this question is truly your field of expertise. So
Oh,
we'll
okay.
start there.
Okay, good, good.
She says, although many people's experiences with near death and other things like that are very much alike, this new reality is still perceived very differently from person to person when they cross over. Isn't the theory about the afterlife just a mirror of your own beliefs? maybe even religious beliefs, or how would you explain that?
Oh boy, that is a that question could be a really long short story. I guess I would start by saying that from my own experience and in exploring there and my experience of teaching people how to explore there, the fact that each individual has a different perception of what that afterlife place is like is completely understandable to me. And it has to do with really the way that our perception works, the way that our consciousness is able to perceive and then interpret what it's perceiving. Mm-hmm. And so if I were to talk for just a couple of minutes about something I call an interpreter and a perceiver, maybe it'll become a little more clear. It's my belief from my experience that all of us have a function in our consciousness that I call a perceiver, and that is pure perception. It's direct, pure perception of whatever surrounds us, whether it's in the physical world or in a non-physical world, and that we are never directly aware of the perceiver's perceptions. Because they come in sort of like raw data. It would be sort of like trying to read a text document on your computer looking at the raw computer code. The information is there, but it needs to be interpreted into a language that we can understand. And that function is handled by something I call an interpreter, another part of our perception, another way that our perception works, another function. And the interpreter function takes the raw data, if you will, from the perceiver and converts it into a translated version that we can understand. It does this in a way that's, I think, responsible for why it is we perceive these realities differently from others. And what I mean by that is that each of us has within our memory the memory of a lot of events, images, ideas, thoughts, words, feelings, emotions. Within our memory, we have a lot of information stored. And the way the perceiver and interpreter appear to work is that as the perceiver brings in the raw data, if mm-hmm. you will, the interpreter sort of sifts through the files in our hard drive, also known as our memory, at least our non-volatile memory, to use a computer metaphor. And the interpreter is looking for the nearest similar thing to match what the perceiver's brought in. And so, for example, I might be in a non-physical reality in which there's, we'll say for the sake of discussion, a cat. Now, as I begin to allow, or as my perceiver begins to bring in information in, it might bring in a raw piece of data that says furry. It might bring another piece of information that says four-legged. And this is just, I'm trying to explain this as just sort of a concept, a way to understand how the interpreter and perceiver work. It might bring in another piece of information that says pointed ears. Now, the interpreter is looking for the nearest similar thing to match those pieces of data. Now, since you and I both know it's a cat, we would expect that we're going to see a cat in our mind's eye, so to speak. But with something like furry, four legs and pointed ears, it could just as well be a dog. Or it could be a variety of rabbit that has four ears. And in fact, one of us, getting that information directly through our perceiver, in our mind's eye, might see a rabbit or a dog. Someone else might see a cat or a mouse. So as the interpreter continues to grab the nearest similar thing, if we sort of keep an open mind and not settle on whether it's a dog, a cat, a rat, or a rabbit, but just allow the perceiver to have some more time to gather information, we might get another piece of information that says long whiskers under the nose. We might begin to get other details that when the interpreter takes everything into account and grabs a nearest similar thing, eventually comes up with cat. Now, all of us probably have memory of seeing at least one cat in our life. And the way I understand the interpreter and perceiver to work is that we may all see a cat, but the interpreter is going to pick the nearest similar thing in your memory or my memory or someone else's memory. And if all of us have seen only one cat in our life, maybe I saw one that was white with brown spots and a big black patch over one eye, and maybe you've only seen one cat in your life that was a little gray kitten, and maybe a third person has only seen one cat in their life, and it was a mountain lion. Each of us, I would see that cat. I would observe that that cat is in non-physical reality, that I'm seeing a cat that looks white with spots and a big black patch over one eye, and you might see the gray kitten, and someone else might see the mountain lion. And we'll all stand there and argue about who's right. I would say, well, it's obviously a white cat with a big black patch over one eye, and you would say, Bruce, you're crazy, it's a kitten. It's a gray kitten. And the other person would say, you people are both nuts. It's a mountain lion. Can't you see that? Well, this concept that the interpreter takes the nearest similar thing that fits all the information so far can cause our perception of the cat to be completely different than another person's. Now, if let's say that all of us have seen 100 cats of many different varieties, that each of us stored in our memory have 100 images of cats, then if the cat that's standing there is actually a calico cat with lots of different colors and patches, all of us have probably seen a calico cat somewhere in those 100 cats. And so each of us might say, oh, it's a cat that's standing here in non-physical reality, and it's a calico cat. So we might then be able to agree that it's a calico cat. It might still be an African tiger in reality, and none of us will ever know because of this interpreter and perceiver. And so for a part of your question, I would say, in my view, it's to be expected that each of us will perceive these areas of consciousness and activity and people there a little differently than someone else. But I remember there was more to your question, just not what the more was.
It was, isn't the theory about the afterlife just a mirror of your own religious beliefs?
Yeah. Ah, well, that's... Yeah, there's another nice, long, short story.
Well, entertain us.
Yeah. Well, I would, in my view, beliefs play a very large part in our perception. I spoke earlier about the interpreter and how the interpreter grabs the nearest similar thing and brings that to our conscious awareness so that we see the cat. Any beliefs we hold that have to do with the cat will also be brought into our awareness, not necessarily aware of the belief, but those beliefs, if we believe, for example, that all cats are dangerous, that belief will cause us to perceive a dangerous cat. If someone believes that all cats are friendly little animals that just love to be petted and scratched, that person will see a friendly cat. So our belief can affect our perception. Now, in terms of religious beliefs, particularly in exploring this afterlife place, I would say that beliefs can have a very profound effect on our own perception of what we see there, who we interact with. For example, if I'm a person who's raised in a religion that says that area of consciousness, that place you call the afterlife, that's filled with demons, and those demons are there just to try to steal your soul and send you to hell, and that those are the only kinds of people that live there. If that's your firm belief, you might have Archangel Gabriel standing in front of you, but because of your own beliefs, you may interpret what you see as a demon, and it may not look like an angel at all. It may have a pointy tail and smoke coming out of its ears and red eyes and carrying a pitchfork, because our beliefs can affect our perception to that level. And so I would say, yes, our beliefs are mirrored back to us in what we perceive. And I would go further and say that our beliefs actually affect what we perceive to the point that a Christian of some particular denomination who has certain beliefs about what the afterlife is going to be like will probably encounter exactly what they expect. A Buddhist who has other beliefs about what it's like will probably encounter exactly what they expect. Someone who's Jewish, someone who's Muslim, someone who's Hindu, someone, name any religion that describes what it's like, and there is the strong possibility that your experience will be colored by that. We could even at some point go further into discussion about some of the areas of consciousness in which we go after we die. And just between you and me, one of those areas we call Focus 23, the people were isolated and alone, and one called the belief system territories. In fact, it might be good just to spend a couple minutes talking about that, because it's a good example of how beliefs can affect our afterlife experience. In exploring this afterlife place, many of us have discovered that this is a place where some people exist who appear to be completely isolated and alone and not in contact with anyone else over there. And those people tend to be what we would call stuck there. And some examples, in my second book, Voyage Beyond Doubt, there's a description of my encounter with a woman who, in all likelihood, believed that when I die, I just go to sleep forever, and I exist in an endless sleep. And that was her belief. And when I encountered her in this afterlife area of consciousness, she was indeed laying on a bed on her back, dressed probably as she had been at her funeral, sleeping. And she was going to remain in that position until someone could convince her that there was more to the afterlife than just sleeping. But her own belief caused her, I would say, to create a reality in which she was alone and sleeping forever. So not just religious beliefs, but our own beliefs about what the afterlife is like can cause us to enter into, essentially, we create our own reality before we die. We almost create something like a dream for ourselves after we die. And some of us at death enter into that dream or self-created reality, such as the woman who was sleeping because that's what she believed. Yeah. Now, there's another area of consciousness that Monroe described as the belief system territories, and I and many, many people have explored this area of human consciousness, human afterlife consciousness, and it's an area where people are stuck, but they're not stuck in isolated individual realities. They're stuck within a reality that's created by the beliefs of a group. So just as a way of illustrating what I mean, I was raised as a Lutheran. And as a Lutheran, I was taught what heaven was like. There were lots of descriptions about what I would do there and what it would be like. It wasn't a particular a teaching of the Lutheran Church at the time, but if they had taught that in heaven there were every tree that bore fruit that ever existed on the earth would be in my heaven, and the fruit would always be perfectly ripe and taste wonderful. At death, if I continued to hold these Lutheran beliefs, I might enter into a place we could describe as Lutheran heaven, a place created by all the Lutherans who believe in it. And if all the Lutherans believed in these fruit trees, those fruit trees would actually be there. And you could actually pick the fruit and eat it, and it would seem like a physical experience. Mm-hmm. Now, as a Lutheran, I was also taught what hell is like. And the descriptions of that place were not very pleasant. Basically, my image of it when I was taught what hell was like was the image of standing sort of waist deep in molten lava for eternity and screaming in pain and wishing somebody would give me a glass of ice water. Unfortunately, or at least lift me out of that rock. That stuff is hot and really uncomfortable. For those Lutherans who believe that they should be punished and spend eternity in hell, not all of them, but some of them may actually enter into a place that is that Lutheran hell. Now, these places are kind of peculiar in that the only people who live in them, who inhabit them, are people who share the set of beliefs that that area is created by. So what that means, in my opinion, is that there's also a Catholic heaven, for example. Catholics have a little different set of beliefs about what heaven is like. And so there's a Catholic heaven and a Catholic hell, and Catholics also have some other areas of afterlife existence. And since their beliefs are a little different, their heavens and hells will mirror back to them their beliefs in the heaven or hell that they believe in. The same for any religious set of beliefs.
Yeah.
Now, some of these belief system territories aren't just religious. It's easier to understand them talking about the religious ones, but in my fourth book, there's a description of exploration of a place called Thief's Hell, a place where all the people who inhabit that particular version of hell hold a belief system of a thief, not someone who just steals occasionally, but a true thief, someone who is always looking for a way to steal something. And that particular place, a place where people believe in that way of living, that way of existing, was inhabited entirely. Every man, woman, and child in the place was a thief. And all of them lived in a place that to them looked very real and three-dimensional, very much like Earth, except every other person there was a thief, and they spent their time stealing from others and being stolen from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's a place that mirrors another way that our own beliefs can be mirrored back to us. Yeah. There's another area of consciousness that Monroe called Focus 27, and that one appears to be an area that's one in which people really aren't stuck in any normal sense of the word. They appear to be in free association with everyone else who's there, free to pretty much do whatever they feel they want to do. I mean, I used to own British sports cars. The last one I had was an Austin Healey. The last one I really loved was an Austin Healey 106, for those of you out there who knows what that car is. And I know that in this place called Focus 27, if I wanted to have, we're going to have to wait for that to get answered and go away. And I'm sure somewhere else in the house will pick it up in a moment. Okay, so back to Austin Healey's. I know that if after I die this time, if I end up in this place called Focus 27, purely by imagining the Austin Healey I'd like, I can create one that appears to be completely solid and fully operational, which probably means I'm going to have it in a garage at least 2 weeks out of every month, because that's just the nature of British sports cars from the 1960s. Incredibly unreliable. Hang on a second. Okay, I'm back. Hopefully that's the end of the phone calls from the outside world here for a moment. That was a friend of mine who's a psychic and medium, and in fact, her picture's on my website. It's Carol Dennis. Yeah. Anyway, back to Austin Healey's again. Essentially, Focus 27 is a place where, in my experience, the people who inhabit that place are the people who would never consider trying to force their will or their beliefs on another person. So everyone there is that sort of person. Everyone there is in free association with all others there, with a lot of places to explore and things to do, and with a little understanding of how you can create any automobile you'd like to drive, if you want to drive one, with really no need to. There's no need to drive there at all. You just want to be someplace, just think about it, and you're there. I kind of wonder how that's going to be. My own mind here sort of jumps from one place to another as my thoughts drift from one place to another. And so I have this horrible fear that I'm going to be in conversation with somebody and suddenly think about what a great time it was canoeing in the North Woods of Minnesota, and suddenly find myself standing in the North Woods of Minnesota saying, wait a minute, where did John go? I was talking to him just a minute ago. a place where you can create anything that you, anything you'd like to have, a big house, small house, a car. My second wife loved shoes. I mean, she had more shoes than... She bought more shoes in a year than I've purchased in my entire lifetime.
So she'd go to shoe heaven.
Yeah, or at least it's a place where if you're a person who really likes shoes, you could essentially decide that you wanted a pair of shoes in your size, in every color there is, in every style that has ever been, and you'd like them all stacked neatly, cataloged with an easy way to find them in a warehouse. God knows how big it would be. If you wanted the shoes. Otherwise, you could just say to yourself, I don't think I'm going to keep the shoes in the warehouse. I'm just going to create a pair on my feet today and see how they look. Yeah. I think that's about as short an answer as I can give. Well, unless it's more of a question.
Maybe I should be afraid to ask the next question then, but it kind of fits perfectly here. Because Jan wants to know, what's the afterlife like for those who don't believe in one?
Ah, well, okay. First, I'd say, in my opinion, that might be a real advantage to be someone who doesn't believe there is one. Because what very often happens is a person who believes that there's no such thing as an afterlife. When you die, it's like someone turns out the switch and you're out. You're in some sort of totally unconscious state. Well, for those who believe that, what very often happens is they die and they're standing in the room where they died. Maybe it's in a hospital room where they died or a hospice. They're standing in the room and they're looking at their own body laying on the bed, and they're looking at all their grieving relatives who were there in a hospice holding vigil waiting for you to die. And you suddenly realize that you died and that you're seeing all of this. That you're aware of all these people. And that's not supposed to be possible. And oftentimes, it's that sort of shock to a person's beliefs that starts to make them think, now, wait a minute. I was absolutely certain that after I died, I was going to be totally unconscious, but it doesn't appear to be that way. It appears to be something different than that. Such a person probably doesn't have very many strong religiously based beliefs, if they've sort of given up on religion or never belonged to one. And so in some ways there can be some advantage for some. At least that's my opinion. It makes it far easier for what I call a helper, a person who lives probably in this Focus 27 place we talked about, who regularly does retrievals. It's maybe easier for such a helper to sort of walk into the scene and be seen by the person who just died and believed there was nothing, and have the helper walk up to them and strike up a conversation with them and describe that, you know, ask them, you know, what's going on and what are you doing, and would you like to go to another place? I can take you to another place if you'd like to check out some other things that maybe you used to not believe in. Of course, there's always the possibility that, sort of like the woman who believed that when she died she would go to sleep forever, there's always the possibility that a person will sort of enter into something like a sleep state. And they may perceive that as a state in which they are asleep and dreaming. Mm. Or they may perceive that as a state in which they are asleep and not dreaming, which is about as close to nowhere as I could imagine. And such a person may, for some length of time, a few minutes, a few hours, a few days, a thousand years, whatever it takes, for such a person who enters into a state in which they're sort of in a state of being asleep and not aware of dreaming, that person may remain stuck in that state until one of these helpers manages to find a way to get through to them, to find a way to, in essence, join into their dream that they're not aware of, get their attention, and then assist them in waking up and moving on to a better place, which is, that's the art of retrieval.
Yeah, because I just thought you mentioned retrievals a couple of times, but we haven't really explained what that is. Yeah.
And if you want to chat about that for a moment,
yeah,
I'd be
maybe
happy
you should
to.
Just explain that.
A little thumbnail. Yeah. Here. Yeah. Well, I think in the in what you might call a natural death, when someone dies in a sort of a natural way, without any extenuating circumstances, typically what happens is that as they shift their consciousness from physical reality to this non-physical reality that we call the afterlife, typically what happens is they will encounter someone they know who has died before them. It could be a relative or a friend, grandparents, parents. It could be a pet. But typically they will encounter someone who has died before them that they will recognize. And when that happens, the natural thing to do is say something like, "Well, gosh, Joe, you died about 10 years ago. What are you doing here?" And Joe might say, well, Bruce, do you understand what's happened?" And I might say, "Well, yes, I see my body laying there on the bed and everybody's leaving and my skin's pretty white. I think I just died." And Joe might say, "Well, yes, Bruce, that's what's happened. You've died. And I've come here to help escort you to a better place in the afterlife. So if you'd just like to come along with me, I'll take you to a better place." And in a normal, natural dying process, that's a retrieval. It's a situation in which someone from that side, someone from this afterlife area who lives there and maybe knows you, will come to you and get your attention so that they can communicate with you and then offer to assist you in going to wherever you'd like to go or to a better place to see what that's like. And in such a case, it's completely your choice, but you might choose to say something like, "Well, okay, I'll go along. I might want to come back here again, but I'll go along for now." And that person will then lead you or lead me to maybe this place we call Focus 27, and maybe I'll then meet more of my friends and relatives and pets or whatever who've predeceased me, who've died before me. And I've made a nice, easy, smooth transition from living in the physical world to living in a pretty good place, in my opinion, in our afterlife. But there are other forms of retrieval. Sometimes, by virtue of the circumstances of a person's death, they may be a little confused as to what happened. For example, there was a woman who accidentally stepped off a curb while waiting for a bus, accidentally stepped off a curb and fell into Russia or traffic, and she was hit by a car and killed. And it happened so quickly that she didn't realize she had died. She just sort of jumped back up onto the sidewalk, not realizing that she was now in a non-physical body, because it looked the same as it did before she died, dressed the same, felt the same. It just sort of happened so fast she didn't realize she died. And in fact, when she tried to communicate with other people who were at the bus stop, she realized they were all screaming and had these frightened looks on their faces, and she couldn't figure out what that was about. But everybody she talked to just seemed to ignore her like she wasn't there. Well, that woman who died suddenly and didn't realize it was what we call a ghost. She was someone who, because it happened so fast and she didn't realize she had died, she thought she was still alive. And at first she thought that when she tried to talk to people, they were just ignoring her, that for some reason they didn't want to talk to her. And after a period of time, she just stopped even trying to communicate with people and just went back to waiting for her bus. She died, I think, somewhere in the middle 1930s in a big city here in the States. And in a workshop, I believe it was in New Hampshire, here in the States, someone who was taking the workshop and was learning to be a retriever played the part of a friend or relative, played the part of the retriever. The woman who was a retriever used a simple process in which she approached the woman waiting at the bus stop in a way that made it easy for the woman there to perceive her and started a conversation with her. and explained, didn't, well, at that point, didn't really explain that she had died, just started a conversation with her and talked to her about what she was doing and learned that she was waiting for a bus, and the retrieving person discovered what city she was in, the woman's name, a lot of detailed information in that conversation. And then as she stood there, she used the next step in the process, which is to invite a helper from Focus 27 into the scene to make contact with this woman. And there's a whole long story about why the woman couldn't do that on her own, but we won't go into it at the moment. But essentially, at that point, one of the helpers came into the scene, and the retriever introduced the woman who had died to the helper, and the helper used a ruse. He pretended to be someone from the bus company who had been sent with a car to take her wherever she wanted to go. And by the time the story finished, the woman who had died was had an encounter with her own grandparents who had died long before her. And it was at that point she realized she had died and she had been retrieved. She had been taken to a better place.
Okay, so that's a way to get people moving on in the afterlife.
A way to get people moved from being stuck in a place where she had been waiting at that bus stop, at least in Earth time, for probably 60 years, at least. She didn't realize it was that long, but she'd been stuck there for 60 years waiting for a bus. And now she had been retrieved, and she was in a place with her grandparents, and she was able to then begin to progress and do whatever comes next. There are lots and lots and lots of situations in which people become stuck. And it's one of the things that we learn in the workshop is a number of techniques that you can use to approach such a person and to make contact with them and join into a conversation with them, and then help them move to a better place with the assistance of a helper. And each time we do that, we learn a little bit more. Sometimes we get information from the deceased person that we can verify. We just had a recent case in a workshop in Japan where in an exercise, a woman encountered a fighter pilot, a Japanese fighter pilot who died in late in World War II. And he had been stuck. He had been stuck since just before the end of World War II. She was able to get his name and the city, the village he was born in, and where he lived and grew up, and the details of information that she had absolutely no other way of knowing. That she later was able to verify using this wonderful modern tool called Google. Where she did a Google search on the man's name and found him and found that all the information she had received was accurate. And he's no longer stuck in a situation in which the last thing he did was he was making a diving attack in his fighter plane on an American ship off the island of Okinawa. And an American fighter pilot evidently got behind him and blew him out of the sky, and he died so quickly that he was just stuck in that. He was stuck at the point just before he died. So he was, in his mind, he was still diving on the American ship making the attack. And he had been doing that since probably early 1945.
Good.
So, retrieval for me is one of the biggest reasons I teach workshops. There are many, certainly not all, I don't know what percentage, but there are many of our fellow human beings who've gotten themselves stuck, and for reasons that you discover by reading my books or talking to me or attending a workshop, they stay stuck, and till one of us is there to provide some assistance. Yeah.
It's good work. Good. Okay. So the next question is actually a very specific one, and since I know that you don't usually do readings, perhaps you can answer in a more broad sense from your experience. Sure. The question is from Björn, who asks, will I have another go with my son who died 19 months ago? Or will they have another time together?
Yes. Hang on a second. Those are always very sad situations for me. The first thing I would say is dreams are the most common form of real contact between those of us living in physical reality and those of us who are living in non-physical reality, or those like his son who have died. That regardless of what scientists or psychologists or others might say about what dreams are, in my view, some of our dreams are real contact with the person who has died. And so starting out by saying that, one of the things I would say is, if you've had any dreams about your son since he died, particularly if those dreams seem to be a little more vivid than usual, or a little more intense than usual, or a little more stand out in your memory than a usual dream, there's a very good possibility that that was actually a meeting with your son. And so I would start by saying that. I guess the next thing I would do is tell you just a short story about a friend of mine, a woman named Chris, who's an airline pilot. In fact, when my wife Farron and I were in Vermont recently, we were at Chris's cabin. Chris's son, who was, I think, 13 when he died, died a very sudden, unexpected death. And, of course, like any parent, Chris was beyond distraught. That's the only way to say it, beyond distraught. And she went to a lot of psychics and a lot of mediums, trying to make contact with her son to find out where he was and what was happening with him and if he was okay. And for all I know, some of those psychics or mediums might have actually made contact and might have actually been able to give some information about the son's situation. But because it was not an experience that Chris had of her own, there was always room for doubt. There was always room for her to say, well, yeah, this medium correctly said that Kevin had short, curly hair and whatever other details. But, it could have been a lucky guess. It could have been this. It could have been that. So while she went to psychics and mediums as a way to get some relief from being just beyond distraught, she began to look for a way to make contact more directly on her own. And I don't recall even how it was that she found out that I was giving a workshop in Salt Lake City, Utah. Krista lives in Phoenix, Arizona, and for those of you who don't know much about the geography over here, It's probably at least an hour plane ride straight north from Phoenix, Arizona to Salt Lake City. So it was a long trip. I don't know how she found out about the workshop, but she came with a goal of discovering if it was possible for her to make contact with her son. This is an emotional discussion.
I can hear that.
Still. By the end of the workshop, she had enough evidence from her own experience that it was possible to communicate with Kevin.
Mm.
That when she went home, she continued to practice what she learned in the workshop. And in a relatively short time, less than a month, was having regular contact and conversations with her son. Now, that's been quite a few years ago. To this day, she still regularly communicates with her son, but it's on a completely different level. Because once she was able to communicate with him through her own experience, that took away the ability to doubt that the experience was real, because it was her own experience. And some of the things that her son Kevin told her and some of the things that he did were things that might fall into the classification of Krissa would have had no way of knowing the information that Kevin gave her except by communicating with him after he died. And that sort of thing happened often enough for Krissa within her own experience that she convinced herself, she became convinced that the only way this is possible is that this is real. I'm really in communication with Kevin. A great relief to her. And it's been, like I say, a number of years. But as time progressed from her first contacts and her first communications, it became sort of like having a son who moved to a distant city. She could communicate with him over the telephone, metaphorically, but she wasn't able to fly there and visit with him. But she could communicate with him. She could talk with him, and she could understand what he was saying back. Sometimes she would have... I hate to use the word visions, because that carries so much baggage. But there were times in her experience when she was fully conscious. As you know, in the workshop, we do these exercises sitting in a chair, fully conscious. So there were times that she was fully conscious and seeing in her mind's eye Kevin, her son, seeing what he was doing, seeing who was there with him, because he brought other deceased relatives sometimes with her, as I recall, to visit with Krissa. I think, if memory serves me correct, her grandfather was one of those. And over a period of time, it became a sort of continuing relationship with her son. Now, it's certainly not something that I can promise is going to happen for everybody as a result of a workshop. But I want this man to know that that sort of thing is possible, and that the biggest barrier to that sort of thing is our own doubts, our own disbeliefs that cause us to say things like, well, it just feels like I'm making this up. It feels like this is probably just some self-deception. Those kinds of thoughts and feelings are probably the biggest barrier to being able to learn how to how to communicate more directly. So at least in dreams, such contact is possible today. It may have even been occurring in the 19 months since the son died. If this fellow is capable of what's called lucid dreaming, which means some people have the experience of sort of waking up in a dream, realizing that their body's asleep in the bed, but they are somehow awake in a dream. That's called a lucid dream. And in a lucid dream, we can make some choices about where we go and what we do. And so it's quite possible that in a lucid dream, I could decide that I wanted to visit with my mother, who died back in the late 1990s, and sort of mentally intend to visit with my mother, and in that lucid dream have my mother show up and have it really be her. So lucid dreaming is a way that can be done in a dream form. And the form of retrieval that I teach is a way to develop the abilities that can allow that to be a more conscious experience, like that of my friend Krista. So at the very least in dreams, there's a simple exercise you could do. And I think it's in the appendix of one of my books, the first or the, I think this appendix of the second book. Yeah. If you were, for example, just to sit down in a quiet place and using his imagination, remember a time that he and his son were together and what they were doing, and to imagine that he is in that scene with his son, it's a way of beginning a contact with his son and be completely open to allowing yourself just to let your imagination run wild. It doesn't matter whether you're making it up or not. If something unexpected happens, which is often a sort of cue that something real is in the process of occurring, something unexpected happens, play along with that unexpected event. Something else to consider, many of us believe that when someone so young dies, a newborn infant, for example, dies, some of us think, well, it would be really hard to communicate with him because he's an infant.
Yeah.
You know, it's a normal, natural, sort of logical conclusion that, in my view, is completely wrong. I'll say the word, wrong. In my view, before we're born into this little baby body, you could consider that we are a full-size, fully capable adult being. And that the process of being born is sort of the process of being crammed down into a little baby body that is totally unfamiliar. I mean, it's your own hand moving around in front of you probably looks like a UFO, for all I know. So, you know, as a sort of fully developed adult, we're sort of cram ourselves down into a little baby body that we can barely get control of at all at first, and gradually do get control of. For the first year, have very little way to verbally communicate with anybody else who lives here. And we become sort of accustomed to being in that little baby body, and at some point before the age of 7, most of us begin to lose memory of who we were before. In my view, if for example, we talked about a newborn infant that died, which certainly is a sad thing, but it happens. In my view, and from my experience in observing newborn infants after they've died, what seems to happen is for some period of time, they go through sort of a rapid growth experience. Mm-hmm. A rapid growth experience where they might metaphorically go from newborn to 1 year old to 2 year old to 3 years old in a space of days, weeks, or months until they get to the point where they're able to communicate more rationally.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have watched this occur, and it's sort of like they suddenly puff up from being this little child to being a fully developed adult again. So they sort of remember who they were in a way that they are that person again. And so the reason I bring it up is don't be concerned that trying to communicate with such a young child is not possible. Don't give it a second thought, because that what we see as a newborn child was most likely a fully developed adult conscious being, and after death as a very little baby, we make progress either extremely rapidly or a little more slowly back to that state. Also be aware that a woman whose late teenage son suicided, she had a very difficult time making contact with him after the workshop. And I kept in contact with her over the phone and via emails. And what happened was that her son died when he was maybe 18. And in one of her attempts to communicate, she encountered him as a four-year-old. He took her by the hand, and they walked off to a little park and sat down on a picnic table and had a nice picnic lunch together and had a chance to talk back and forth. And one of the things she asked him was, "Why do you look like you're 4 years old?" And his response was, "Well, Mom, if I came here looking the age I did when I died, 19 years old, because of your grief at my death at that age, you would identify with that and not with me as I really am. So I've appeared as a four-year-old because when I was 4 years old and we were interacting, none of that had happened yet." So also be aware that the age of the child can move in either direction.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah. I hope that's helpful.
I just thought perhaps I could attach that part of your book, if that's okay with you.
Perfect.
Perfect. Perhaps it's even on your website. I don't remember.
But, And do you know the son's name?
Oh, I don't remember.
Okay. The father's name again?
Bjorn.
Bjorn. Yeah. Okay. Can you hold on just a second? One of the things I might suggest, when I talked about that he might, in a quiet place, imagine a time when he and his son were together, I would suggest that if there was a time when he was holding his son, to my perception, it would have been sort of holding him with both arms, and the son is... sort of has his head up on dad's shoulders with his feet and his body pointing straight down. So he's just kind of holding his son, maybe even sitting in a chair.
I have his first name, actually.
Yeah. At this point, I don't need the son's name. But I would say that when the father imagines a time that he and his son were together, at least one of the times that you do this imagine such a time when you were holding him and talking or singing to him, and be open to the possibility of communication with him. One more thing to mention before we leave this topic. Very often what happens when we're trying to make contact with someone that we're grieving for, particularly if we're still strongly grieving, as we say in our mind, wish or ask or intend that they come to us. In my view, what happens is they do come to us. And the closer they get to us, metaphorically speaking, the closer they get to us, the more we feel their presence. And what I mean by that is if you're sitting in a room by yourself, and someone that you know, maybe your spouse, walks into the room and sits down in a chair in the room, you feel that person's presence. It feels different than when you're alone in the room. Now, in my experience, what can happen is that as you wish and intend and hope and ask that the deceased person come to you, they begin to come to you, and you begin to feel their presence. And the closer they get, the stronger you feel their presence. If you're still in a strong state of grief, it's not unlikely that as a result of you feeling their presence, you will start thinking about how much you miss them, and how much you're grieving over them, and start feeling the pain of that grief, and try to push that pain away, because it's that sort of grieving pain is very uncomfortable. And so very often people will then try to push that grieving pain out of their mind so they can be ready to communicate with the person. In my experience, what's happening is that because you're feeling the presence of the person approaching you, it's stimulating your feelings of loss, and the pain you are feeling is a direct result of feeling their presence. And when you push the pain away, try to clear that pain out of your mind, that grieving pain, you're pushing them away. And so you then go back to trying to make contact with them or asking them to come, and the same thing might happen. You start feeling those feelings of grief and the pain of it all, and you try to push that pain out of your mind. Again, you're pushing them away. And you would say after the experience, no, they didn't come. I didn't feel them there. They didn't talk to me. I don't know why they can't communicate with me. I really wish they could communicate with me. I don't know why they don't do it. It's because in pushing the pain away, you're pushing them away. You're closing off your awareness of their presence, which closes off your awareness of any communication that might come in the form of images or thoughts or feelings or even words they might say. So for those who are still in strong grief, if you're in sort of a meditative state and you're asking them to please come, and you start to feel the pain of their loss, the grief of their loss, in my opinion, what I just described is what's going on. And part of the act of healing that grief is being willing to feel their presence and stick with it.
Yeah.
Need to take a breath. Okay. I'm back. shifted back to the area of consciousness I was in before I started that conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yes, the Father will have contact with the Son.
Good.
Yeah,
perhaps
good.
That's it.
Yeah.
Or.
Yeah. Well, then for those who are just are never able to allow themselves to sort of work through the pain of the meeting or the grief of it and heal that, some people, it may turn out that one of the people who comes to meet you when you die will be one of those people you were trying to make contact with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Sure.
I can assure you that the rest of the questions are not so emotional.
Yeah. Well, I don't mind feeling emotion. It just sometimes makes it hard to talk.
That's true. Should we move on to the next question?
Yeah. Yes.
That's a quite different one, actually. Perhaps not very afterlife related, but it might be. So we'll try it. It's a question from Peter, who wrote to me that recently he saw a headline of an interview with some actress who said, I'm keeping the dark away, or keeping the dark side away. And that made him think, aren't you a much more whole human being if you embrace both sides of yourself? In Peter's opinion, you're a much better person if you can and will handle both sides, because there's no dark without light, and both sides are needed for a whole and unique person. And he'd like to know your views on that.
Well, I completely agree with him. And my own experience of that is also related in, I think, the third book. But my own experience of that is that all of us have parts of ourselves that we're not too proud of. We all have parts of ourselves that we might hide from others because we're concerned about what other people might think if they know that you know, I have these kinds of feelings or thoughts, or I'm this kind of person or that kind of person. And when we do that, when we hide those parts of ourselves from other people, it's, in my view, from my experience of having gone through that, what we're really doing is denying that those parts of ourselves are real, denying that they have a right to exist, denying that they have any useful role to play in our lives. And these are parts of ourselves that we may actually lose touch with to the point that we're not even conscious that we are that person. A silly example. There are sometimes, at least in my past, it never happens now. There are sometimes that I would say that things that happen around me can cause me to be in a murderous rage. Some years ago, I was in that state of mind when a psychologist, well, it's a long story, but suffice it to say that I had a strong disagreement with a psychologist as to how my 7-year-old son should be treated and with what kinds of drugs. And if I could have reached through the telephone and got him by the throat, I would still be in prison. So this, there is this part of Bruce that I would say is someone who is in a murderous rage. And it's a part of myself that I certainly didn't want to expose people to, partly because I thought I was really a dark side of myself. It was a part of myself that should never be allowed to see the light of day. And so I never would even talk about such a thing with someone. And if I began to have those feelings, I would do everything I could do to talk myself out of having those feelings. But I completely agree with the person who asked the question. It made me a less whole human being. Because there are particular situations where being someone who is in a murderous rage would be entirely appropriate to the situation. I mean, for example, I'm walking down the street at night and with my wife, and someone walks up with a knife and says, "Give me your purse and give me your wallet," and stabs my wife. I think it's completely and totally appropriate that I be in a murderous rage and kill the mofo. So maybe it's an extreme, silly example, but...
Yeah, but it's a useful side in that situation.
In a particular situation, under certain circumstances, it's a useful side. Now, one of the dangers, in my view, of trying to separate those parts of myself and deny their existence is that I may actually create what I call an aspect of myself. I may sort of spin off a kind of small version of Bruce, or a narrower personality version of Bruce, that is just a being that's always in a murderous rage. And I may actually manage to spin off that fragment or aspect of myself to the point that I'm no longer ever consciously aware that I have that trait or that that is a part of me. It certainly doesn't have to be as dramatic as a murderous rage. It could be anything. It could be any part of myself that I don't want to know about. If I manage to spin that part of myself off, separate myself from that fragment of myself, or what I call an aspect of myself, thoroughly enough, what may actually happen is that when I physically die, I may leave that aspect of myself within an area of consciousness very close to physical reality. And that aspect of myself will appear to be a separate being who is just a person in a murderous rage. If I have died and left that part of myself here, separated myself from that aspect of myself, when I die, I may leave that part of myself here, and now someone who understands the art of retrieval, someone who's been trained or learned how to do retrieval, in a retrieval exercise may come across that part of me, maybe, think that it's a whole human being when it's really just a fragment of a human being, and use what they've learned to retrieve that fragment of me so that that fragment of me can, in essence, rejoin me as a more whole being in whatever afterlife area of consciousness I presently exist. And I become a more whole being. I'm less fragmented. Now, throughout our lives, I mean, I certainly had quite a number of parts of myself that for a long time I had separated myself from so successfully that if I had died, I'd have left them here as aspects. And if nobody else could retrieve them, I'm half convinced that one of the reasons some of us reincarnate is to come back into physical reality so that we can retrieve those aspects of ourselves back into ourselves before we die, so that when we do, we take more of ourselves with us and we are a more whole, integrated being. In my, like I say, I'm at least half convinced that part of the reason for reincarnation is to retrieve these aspects of self. And in fact, the third workshop that I teach is a workshop in which people learn to retrieve aspects of self from our present lifetime and also from past lifetimes. And in my experience, as I began to, I mean, it's really all about self-acceptance. It's all about self-love. I mean, if you can't love every part of yourself and accept every part of yourself as worthy to exist, in my view, you're in trouble. you are not a whole integrated being, and there are parts of you that you've left scattered here and there, and at some point, in order to be a more whole human being, you're going to have to retrieve those aspects of yourself.
That reminds me, I've come across people who, when I tell them about your workshops and what you teach, they get this very frightened look on their face and say, oh, you shouldn't mess with those things yourself. You should have a therapist guide you through this retrieving the aspects of yourself, because certain aspects could surface that will cause traumas and get you in a state that you can't recover from yourself. How do you feel about those warnings that you shouldn't mess with these things yourself? You must have heard them before.
Oh yes, I've heard those before, and I've also witnessed what happens when you decide not to to take that advice. First of all, I would say that there may be a grain of truth in not messing with those things, only because I think someone who doesn't understand what they're doing and doesn't understand the potential impact, how this can affect your own identity and how it can affect your beliefs and how it can affect who you are. I think someone who will say just be playing with this without any knowledge of what they're doing may encounter an aspect of themselves that when they retrieve that aspect causes what I call a belief system crash, which is a shrink might call an identity crisis. When we retrieve such an aspect of ourselves, so that it comes back into us, it becomes a part of us again as a more whole being, it changes our identity. And any change in our identity can result in a very specific set of what we might call symptoms. And if you looked at an identity crisis, you'd see the same set of symptoms, feelings of disorientation, depression, disassociation, feelings like you might die soon. There's a whole list of feelings you can go through as a result of retrieving such an aspect of yourself. And for the person who undertakes retrieving aspects of self, I think it's very important that they understand really what they're doing and the likely impact, how to recover from that impact, and what it means to do this. I taught the first two workshops for a number of years, and then encountered a spontaneous, in an ordinary workshop, a woman spontaneously recovered a part of herself, retrieved an aspect of herself from childhood that she described as her childhood innocence. At some point when she was a little girl, for some reason she was not able to hang on to her childhood innocence anymore and spun it off as an aspect. And during an ordinary retrieval exercise, she was guided by her helper to retrieve that aspect of herself, to sort of bring that childhood innocence part of her that she had spun off back into herself, to reintegrate. And it was a fascinating process. It turned out that she was a psychotherapist. And I maintained contact with her for a little over a month after the workshop. She was in the San Francisco Bay Area. And she described that what she was going through was the sort of thing that she might work for months or years with a client for them to be able to recover that part of themselves and integrate that part of themselves into their identity to be a more whole person. And that for her, this thing happened in a space of the initial recovery in a space of minutes. And by the end of about 30 days, she felt she had fully integrated that back into herself. So I would say that with proper training, this is something that can be done. Now, when that spontaneous one happened, I thought, well, you know, that seemed to really be a good thing to do. I think I'm going to develop an exercise, and in the next workshops that I give, I'm going to do a retrieving an aspect of self exercise to encourage people to have this experience. And the result was so dramatic that I stopped teaching that and didn't teach it again for probably 8 years. Because in the one workshop that I taught the exercise, three people retrieved aspects of themselves, and the change in their identity was so strong that it completely disrupted their ability to function. And in one woman's case, she got home from the workshop and she literally sat in a chair doing nothing because she couldn't get out of the chair for like 2 days. That scared me. But as I follow along with her, again by phone and by email over a period of a couple of weeks, what I saw was that she began to integrate this part of herself. It turned out that when she was a very little girl, maybe somewhere between the ages of 2 and 4, she evidently had some rather strong psychic abilities. And she began to tell her parents and her siblings and her relatives about future events that were going to happen that then did indeed happen. Which would have been fine, except that the religion of her family was a religion that believed that this sort of activity was the work of the devil. And so every time she did anything like that, she was severely punished and told not to do this anymore. And somewhere about the age, somewhere age 2 to 4, she spun off that aspect. She fragmented that part of herself away and locked it up in a cave. And during the workshop, she was guided by her helper to that aspect of herself and took that aspect back into herself. And she basically went from a strongly fundamentalist Christian housewife to a full-blown, fully capable psychic in minutes. And so all of a sudden, she's knowing things are going to happen, and then they're happening, and you can see the sort of thing would happen to a person. you could think you're going crazy. I guess to try to sum up and not carry this on too much longer, I would say that without any training at all, it's probably best not to do this,
mm-hmm.
unless you get some sort of guidance to do this. I think it's best not to do this. That you at least need some training, and that's what the third workshop gives. Is it gives some training and some understanding of what you're doing. Plus, you've already been through the first two workshops, and you've encountered enough things that have changed your identity and your beliefs that it's a little easier to handle. Trying to hide the darkness, I couldn't agree with doing that.
So, but it's mostly the aspects of self that can cause these identity crises. I mean, retrievals of other people is not something that you'd usually warn about. I mean, you do it.
And there are times when I trust helpers. I mean, you might call them angels, you might call them guides or spirit guides. I use a generic term, helper. And so everything that's done in my workshop, in terms of your experiences during the exercises, is left to your own helpers and guides to determine what's best for you and what's best not done yet. There are some people who, in a first workshop, may encounter something that conflicts with their beliefs. And it's a long discussion, but essentially when you have an experience that conflicts with your beliefs, there's a connection between your beliefs and your identity that can cause this belief system crash or identity crisis. And so occasionally people in a workshop will have such an experience. But I haven't had anybody end up in a psych hospital yet. Maybe I shouldn't say yet. And nobody's sued me for damage.
And you live in a country where people would actually do that.
We now have advertised on television. There's an attorney who gets on television and says, if you need an attorney, pick up your cell phone and dial pound, the number 4, and the word law. Pound for law. On your cell phone, no, pound for law. If you're in an accident waiting for the ambulance, dial pound for law. If you're in the ambulance and can call, once you arrive at the hospital, he doesn't say this, but it's almost to the point where, we can have a lawyer meet your ambulance in the emergency room. People in this country are looking for a way to make money, and lawyers are really high on the list of those. And, this is a very, very, this culture, people sue.
But that's a whole lot of other discussion, I guess.
A little off the discussion. But I hope there's a special place for all those lawyers. And I hope they end up defending themselves in court for a long time. That was not a nice thing to say, Bruce. Well, I don't care. It's okay to say it. It is okay to talk to yourself as long as you don't say, what?
One other question from Jan, who asks, what is energy?
Oh, what is energy?
That's a very big question.
Well, that's a really good question because I can't think of anything that is not energy. My college education started out as in physics because I was really curious about what makes things tick, and I thought it was the physicists who would understand that. And so I know from that and other things that if you take the one of the smallest atoms of matter, which is hydrogen, and if the center of that atom was about the size of a soccer ball, the one electron orbiting it is probably about 20 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really not much in there that's truly mass or matter. And in fact, what physicists will tell you is it seems to be that the thing we call the nucleus, the soccer ball part, and the thing we call the electron are just some particular energy at some particular vibrational state. But I suspect that's not really what his question is. What is energy?
Your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah, and like I said, the first thing I would say is I can't think of anything that is not energy. Energy is kind of a... Well, there isn't really a word, I suppose, for the kind of energy I think he's thinking about. But if I were going to come up with one that's similar, I would say consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
That energy and consciousness are probably, in the context of metaphysical things, are probably two words that mean the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that I would differentiate between, well, that's a long word. Anyway, I would differentiate between a state that you might call raw, unorganized consciousness, which is probably could be thought of as sort of a raw, chaotic state of energy. And that consciousness has a way of sort of transforming that raw, unorganized consciousness into something organized. And that organized thing could be a thought, or it could be an impression, or it could be an image, or it could be something that appears to be solid, like the room I'm sitting in right now, and the computer monitor I'm looking at appear to be solid. Those seem to be some sort of more organized energy or more organized consciousness. But, yeah, what is energy? How would you answer a question like that?
I could perhaps add a question of my own.
Sure.
Because I came to think of healing when healers work with energy. I mean, they use that word in a different mm-hmm. sense, perhaps. I mean, the kind of energy you can give to somebody or move around somehow, non-physical mm-hmm. energy.
Yeah, my wife is a Reiki master, and if you talk to her about what is energy in the context of Reiki, mm-hmm. yeah, she would say, well, it's something that... the practice of Reiki is a way of learning how to allow whatever that something is to come through the Reiki practitioner and be transferred into the person that needs that energy, whatever that is, and that a Reiki practitioner essentially just intends for that specific energy to go wherever it needs to go.
Yeah.
And in Reiki, there are symbols used. Since I'm not a Reiki master or even a Reiki novice, I don't know what those symbols are. But I know that Reiki people imagine a specific symbol.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, that's a sort of that symbol represents a particular kind of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so the imagining or remembering the symbol is a way of sort of connecting to that kind of energy. I just recently finished rereading a book that came out back in, I think, 1994, if not before, called The Celestine Prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a book a lot of people have read.
Yeah.
And I think it gives one of the most coherent explanations of energy and how it's used, how it's gathered, what it's used for, and a number of ways to use it, that I might suggest that if the person who asked the question hasn't ever read the Celestine Prophecy, it would be a good read.
Okay. I might just add that the Danish title is Den 9. Indsigt, for those who,
okay.
who don't know what
yeah.
the English title is. Yeah.
Yeah. In the workshop, there are a couple of exercises in which we learn to gather energy from above and energy from below.
Yeah.
And we talk about gathering the energy of love, and we talk about projecting energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I'm not a really good source of a really good answer for the question, what is energy?
Nope.
Nope.
Or maybe you are.
Okay.
Maybe it can't be answered.
Yeah. Maybe more will come later.
Yeah. I just remembered something, and I don't know if you want to tell that, but you told a very interesting story to me during the workshop regarding the Reiki energy and the Reiki symbols. You said you did a little experiment with Farron and some kind of machine you had.
Yes. That is kind of an interesting story.
Yeah. Suitable for an...
really an interesting event.
Yeah.
I'm working on an electronic device that's intended to become a sort of communication link between the non-physical world and the physical world.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of years ago, I had a prototype of that device running. And a professor from a university in Texas contacted me and said he would like to come up and take a look at what I was doing.
Yeah.
And we had already learned that that the device could detect something.
Mm-hmm.
And so we hooked him up to it and described to him how to sort of just get into a relaxed state, and we would see whatever would happen. This particular device was designed so that the output was an audio tone, a tone that played into the room so you could hear it.
Mm.
And depending on what the device detected on the person's skin or through the person's energy field, that's a better way to put it because it wasn't any kind of direct contact with skin. So the device essentially is detecting something about the human energy field. And if the human energy field changes, the audio tone goes up and down in frequency.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of sets the stage to describe what happened. So we hooked the professor up to the device, and the audio tone didn't move anywhere. We had him relax. We had him try all sorts of things. And the audio tone just didn't move. It stayed at a constant low frequency, the low frequency that we have it start out on. And I had the impression that this guy's energy field or aura might have extended just a tiny bit past his skin. He seemed to be kind of a person whose energy was either extremely low or he had his field pulled in. And so I asked Farron if she'd like to try some Reiki with this guy, because in our conversations he knew that Farron was a Reiki master, and so she said sure. And the professor was sitting in a chair,
mm-hmm.
kind of leaned back and comfortable. And so Farron moved around so that she was standing next to his head, and she put her hands down without touching him. Her hands are maybe 6 inches away or so. And as we're listening, at first the audio tone stays where it is. And then it did something unusual in that the audio tone made a step change, or a change that went, instead of going something like ah, it just went from ah to ah.
Mm-hmm.
So the audio tone frequency indicated there was a change in this fellow's energy field.
Yeah.
And normally what we heard, what we'd hear with a change in the energy field is more of a ah, we'd hear shifts in the tone.
Mm.
But it didn't do that. It just went from ah to ah, and it stayed there.
Yeah.
Stayed there for quite a while. And Farron continued doing whatever she does when she does Reiki. And it made another jump in frequency. So it went from ah to ah, higher.
Yeah.
And it stayed there. Again, a very unusual. And for the next several minutes, as she continued to do Reiki, the frequency every once in a while would jump up to a higher frequency and then stay there. And when she got all finished, Farron remarked that it was kind of interesting that it was just as she was mentally changing the symbol that she was using,
yeah,
that the audio tone changed. It was surprising to me,
mm-hmm,
because it seems to indicate that the state of the professor's energy field was directly affected by what Farron was doing with her Reiki.
Yeah.
And that each symbol had a definite step change, and then it stayed at that energy state, whatever that was,
mm-hmm,
until she changed the symbol again.
Yeah.
And in fact, after that experience, I thought, maybe we should look at building some sort of electronic device that uses the principles that we've just incorporated into this prototype.
Mm-hmm.
And use it as a way that Reiki trainers could teach other people how to do Reiki.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that Farron always talked about as she was learning Reiki was, I really don't know if what I'm doing is having any effect. Because normally when you begin to learn Reiki, you're just standing there, maybe with your eyes closed, and you're imagining a symbol, and you don't get any feedback.
Yeah.
Unless the person that you're giving Reiki energy to comments that there's some change.
Right.
For some time I thought, you know, that'd be a great Reiki training tool,
mm-hmm,
because you'd be able to actually be doing Reiki and change a symbol and the tone frequency would change. It would give you some feedback, and that feedback is a way of telling you, I'm doing something.
Yeah, that would be great.
yeah, because there's a certain level of confidence.
Yeah.
That seems to be required in doing anything, and I think a person makes a lot more progress in learning how to do Reiki when they have some feedback.
Mm.
And just as an aside, if there's someone interested in learning more about how such a device might work, who might be interested in doing something with it,
mm-hmm,
yeah, contact me. There was one other event that was somewhat similar.
Okay.
And I'm not sure I've told you this story before, but for those in the audience who are familiar with the Monroe Institute, you're probably familiar with HemiSync and the various focus levels that are taught in the very first Monroe Institute program, Focus 10,
mm,
which is mind awake, body asleep, and Focus 12 and 15 and 21 and so forth. An earlier prototype of this communication device was working on it in Virginia, and I had some friends stop by the lab where we were working, and my wife Farron was there at the time too. And a fellow named Jim said he wanted to try it out. And so we brought him into the room with it and got him hooked up to it. And the three of us myself and my wife Farron and Jim's wife Jenna remained in the room, and we just sat on the floor and relaxed and intended to send energy to Jim. There wasn't any Reiki involved or anything, just intended to send energy to Jim. And the device was similar in that it put out an audio tone. And as we all sat there, we again, or not again, because this was the first time it happened, but what we heard was the same thing that I heard when Farron did Reiki. Jim was sitting there connected to the device and had his eyes closed and evidently was relaxed. The audio tone started out low, and then again it jumped to another frequency. Mm. So it went and stayed there.
Yep.
And it did that, I think, in 7 steps. Mm. Each of those steps were held for maybe a minute. And then it came back down with the same step intervals over a period of several minutes back to the original tone. Mm. And that was the first time we'd ever heard anything like that happen that was not associated with Reiki. Mm. And when I asked Jim if he was doing something during that little session, he said, well, yes. He said, I've always wondered if those focus levels that Monroe talks about are real or not. You know, are those things real or are they just something we're pretending?
Yeah.
So he said, what I did was, after I got myself a little relaxed, I went to focus 10 and I heard the tone change. Then I went to focus 12 and heard the tone change again. Mm. And he did that all the way to the area of consciousness that Monroe calls focus 27, which you heard about earlier in our discussion here. And then he intentionally went back down through each of the focus levels back to 10, and the tone stepped back down. So there's definitely something to the Monroe Institute's HemiSync system.
Yeah.
And the device is capable of detecting it. Mm. So more about something about energy, whatever that is.
Yeah. But it's interesting that it can be measured with your device.
Yes. I don't know anybody else who has ever demonstrated anything like that with Reiki or with HemiSync.
No. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it certainly verifies that something is going on.
Yeah.
So perhaps we should move on to
the next question.
Next question.
Yes. And this is from Stine, who attended a couple of your workshops here in Denver.
Oh, I remember Stine.
Yeah,
I remember Stine.
She asks what you know about other civilizations out there. Have you come across any? Yeah.
Yeah, other civilizations, as in the folks that we might call aliens.
Yeah, I think that's what she means. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yes. As a matter of fact, I have had some experience in that regard. Some of that experience was that took place during Monroe Institute programs that I attended. And in fact, in the latter part of my third book, the English title is Voyages into the Afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
There's a discussion of some exploration into an area of consciousness that Monroe called the Gathering. And for those of you who have read Monroe's, I believe, second book, he described that area of consciousness as a place where what he described as intelligences, because I think he was afraid to use the word aliens, that intelligences are sort of gathered there to observe the Earth and to observe humankind to see what we do and what we're up to. And in during one of the Monroe Institute programs, there's some exercises done there. And when you explore using HemiSync, this gathering, it was also known as Focus 34/35. I'm not sure why Monroe couldn't make up his mind between 34
I wondered about that.
I don't know. I don't know if it was. He just couldn't quite, you know.
Or maybe it's on the edge.
Yeah, maybe it's between the two. It could be. Could be. Or maybe it spans both of them. I don't know. But, you know, in that particular, those particular exercises, at first, what I encountered were just strange sort of shapes. And one of them that I wrote about in that particular book that I think is just funny looking back at it, I'm sort of wandering around in this area of consciousness trying to detect something, you know, laying in a little darkened cubicle with my eyes closed, trying to have some sort of visual image of something. Mm. And something that looked like a giant puffball came into view. Mm. Now, I'm not sure how well puffball translates into Danish, but a puffball is it's a living thing, and it's a fungus, and it's a ball of fungus that maybe starts out the diameter of a golf ball, and some of these grow up or grow and expand to be as large as a soccer ball or a basketball. Mm. And as a kid, when you come across one, what you always do is step on it. Because when you do, it squirts out these green spores and a huge cloud of green smoke. So anyhow, something like a giant puffball came into view. And to my perception, I heard some sounds that were totally unrecognizable. It kind of sounded like, had no idea what that meant. And I sort of mentally projected out to this giant puffball that that I was there and I'd like to try to communicate with it. And I again heard some, which meant nothing to me.
You forgot your then, alien English dictionary.
Yeah, I didn't have the alien English dictionary or translator or anything. And as I sort of watched it, it began to sort of jiggle, sort of like a big ball of jello. And a little ball of jello sort of popped out. And when it communicated, it communicated in English, as far as I could tell, although I now understand how that works a little better. And this little thing said something like, well, I'm just a portion of the whole, and I understand you'd like to communicate, and it appeared from our previous attempts to communicate with you that you did not understand us. And I said, well, as a matter of fact, I didn't. That's correct. And so I proceeded to sort of interview this little ball of jello that came out of the puffball. And I must not have phrased my question right, because I asked this person something about, well, where do you come from? And when I did that, I meant, you guys have a civilization on another planet, or where do you live? But, and I expected him just to, you know, point maybe with some little jello finger at where they were. And in the conversation before that, he'd explained that they were sort of like a news crew. And he talked very fast with a high, squeaky voice, and he said something like, you know, we're here kind of like the news crew, and we gather up some information and we send it back to our home world. You know, kind of like the news is coming, film 11. You know, he was trying to communicate as best he could using whatever power of English he had or whatever he was speaking. And it was at that point that I said something about, well, you know, where do you come from? Where do you live? Where do you send the film at 11? That's probably something I said, and that was probably my mistake. Because he sort of stopped and looked at me, and he said, oh, okay. And I suddenly felt like I was sort of sitting in some kind of little chair, chaise lounge, in some sort of little vehicle thing, and I'm looking straight ahead, and there's this bright yellow beam that goes sort of straight out from where I'm sitting, and it goes, and I can see the stars of outer space, and this beam just sort of goes way out, and I don't know how far, it was light years that it went out, and then it made kind of a quick turn to the left a little bit and continued on, and all of a sudden this thing I'm sitting in starts moving. And it's moving along the path that this yellow beam is. And there's no way for me to describe the sensation of speed. I know that we kept following this yellow beam, and we passed, it could have been millions of light years that we traveled. I could see a star field in front of me, and I could see that this beam had a turn in it, and when we went through the turn in the beam, the star field suddenly switched to seeing a different one, and it literally could have been millions of light years that we traveled. I have no idea, but we went fast. It probably took less. We went fast. It didn't take seconds until I see that we're there ahead. There's sort of a bright, looks like a star in front of me, off in the distance, and I feel that we're slowing down, and we come to a stop, and I'm looking at a planet. It wasn't a star we were approaching. It was a planet. And it's mostly beige colored, like maybe most of the surface is covered with sand. That's kind of how it looked. Mm. And the little guy is sitting next to me, and he said, well, this is it. This is my home world. This is where we live. This is where I send the film at 11. Is that okay? And I said, I was completely and totally dazed, and I sort of mumbled, yeah, that's okay. And he said, okay. And we went backwards along the same route. At the same speed, we probably traveled millions of light years, and the whole experience took less than 10 seconds. We came back to where we started, and I am just totally blown away. I can sort of look around, but I'm not really seeing much. I think being in shock is close to the state I was in. And I could tell he was right in front of me, kind of looking at me. And he said something like, are you okay? Well, in more exploration of that place, I came across a group that in the book I describe as a second GATH group.
Yeah.
Which is short for the second group that I met at the gathering.
I can't wait to translate this, by the way.
Yeah, well, second group I met at the gathering. Well, it's abbreviations, so I'm not sure how you'll do that. Maybe just write out second group I met at the gathering. But in my further explorations of this area of consciousness that Monroe described, I came across the group that I called a second GATH group. And without taking hours to tell the short story, these, to my perception, were basically a humanoid race of beings. And in my conversations with them, it did sound like they lived on something like a planet. I'm not sure it was in our universe, in our physical universe, or some other physical universe, or some other dimension. I'm really not certain of that. But had some long discussions with a spokesman from that group. And he described their form of consciousness, which was very peculiar to me. And in fact, all of the civilizations that we would describe as non-human and humanoid, as opposed to animals living on the earth, we'll just say aliens, what the heck. All of these alien races that I've encountered have a similarity, And the similarity has been that none of them appear to have what we would call an individual that exists separately from the group of them.
Mm.
They appear to be something you might describe as a group mind, in which all members of that race essentially use or form a single, metaphorically, brain.
Mm-hmm.
And so that every thought any of them has is a thought that all of them have.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like human beings where I can sit here and have thoughts that I believe to be completely and totally separate from other human beings,
mm-hmm.
and other human beings do the same. In all of these races that I've encountered, they seem to be using a single mind. I guess a mind is a better word than brain.
Mm.
The other thing that's been common amongst all of them is that I have yet to meet any that experience what we humans would describe as emotion.
Mm.
And in fact, in my discussions with the spokesman from their group, he explained that they too were explorers, and they were here in this area of consciousness to observe the earth and to observe the humans, because there was some big event that was going to be occurring soon,
mm.
and they wanted to record and study this event. So that if something like this ever happened to their race on their home world, they would at least have some idea of what it was that was happening.
Mm.
And further in the conversation, I said something to him about, as we talked more about this event, I think I might have asked him something like, can you describe what the emotional impact of this event will be for humans? And his reply was indicated by the fact that he couldn't really reply.
Mm.
His reply indicated that the word emotion did not exist anywhere in their vocabulary. It was not a concept that they had any understanding of or experience of. They were maybe a little like engineers, completely emotionless by virtue of the fact that they were completely unable to identify emotion or experience emotion. We had quite a bit of interaction spaced over a number of years, and in fact the story of that begins in my third book, Voyages into the Afterlife, and continues on into the fourth book, Voyage to Curiosity's Father. That voyage word got into the title of every one of my books, and it was Hampton Roads that did that. I wanted to just have it be Curiosity's Father, but oh well. But in that book, there's more information about contact and communication with this one I call Second Gath Group. And in fact, in Curiosity's Father, the experiences that I write about with Second Gath Group indicate that they had changed as a result of the contact that we had and some of the experiences that we shared in my first contact with them. They had actually begun to recognize a form of individuation, a way of having individual traits instead of being all one big, huge group mind. And that they also had begun to experience some emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the one that they demonstrated that they understood, and they demonstrated it really well, was the feeling of love.
Mm.
And in our first meetup, In fact, that the feeling of love was one that that a group of us demonstrated for them in a way that sort of put it into their consciousness in a way that they would directly experience it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I've run into a number of them.
Yeah. How, I was wondering, maybe you could explain how vivid are your experiences, because when you talk about moving fast and all that, maybe people think that you're in an out of body state, or like Monroe was, or
yeah, a lot of people think that that what I'm writing about are out of body experiences, and I must confess that after I read Monroe's first book, Journeys Out of the Body, I spent a number of years trying to learn how to consciously do this out-of-body thing that Monroe described, and I was never really successful. Maybe five times in my life have I had what I would describe as a classic out-of-body experience. And at least three of those were ones in which I had been trying and trying and trying over a long period of days to manage to consciously go out of my body. And then sometime in the middle of the night, when I least expected it, I'd suddenly find myself like standing next to my bed, looking at myself in the bed and think, oh, great, I made it out. And then there was this loud sort of crack sound, and I was back into my body again.
I know that feeling. Damn.
Yeah, yeah. At least three of the five times I've had were just like that.
Yeah.
So I would not describe what I'm doing as an out-of-body experience. I would describe what I'm doing something that's maybe better described as more of a mental exercise. And so when people read my books, oftentimes they'll think that when I describe that I'm flying over a forest and observing this or seeing that, people will think that, oh, he must be having an out-of-body experience. Mm. But I would describe, I guess, that in those experiences, that for me, it's just more of, I'm a sort of point of perception with the sensation oftentimes of movement, and rarely clear visual imagery. And I say that rarely because one of the things that I teach in terms of how to perceive beyond physical reality is that we have what you might call non-physical senses, in my opinion. Mm. So we have a physical sense of sight, and those of us who have our physical sight tend to see things in three dimensions and full color, and it appears to be a motion, a moving set of images as opposed to still images, and they're pretty clear. And when I first began to explore beyond physical reality, I expected I would see in that same way, using my non-physical sense of sight. It didn't turn out that way. And in fact, I was quite disappointed with the way it did turn out, because it turns out that our non-physical sense of sight is something that operates a sort of along a continuum of visual experience. And on one end of that continuum, the visual experience that I have when I'm exploring or when others are exploring might be described as identical to physical reality. That's on one end of the continuum of visual experience. Mm. But that happens very rarely for me. And if we move from that end of the continuum gradually toward the other end of the continuum, then we find that non-physical sense of sight is sometimes very clear, three-dimensional, holographic, but it's black and white. Mm. And it may still be moving images. And if we move further toward the other end of that continuum, we might get to a point where it's kind of a fuzzy black and white, kind of like an old black and white TV set with a really bad antenna. So you can sort of make out images in a visual way, still sort of see things, but they're really not very clear, not very focused. They might still be moving, or they might be still images. And as you continue to move toward this other end of the continuum of our non-physical sense of sight and the experience of that, you come to the other end of the continuum, which is where I operate most often. And that's the visual experience of, I guess I would describe it best as what you would perceive visually if you were in a room with no doors and no windows and no lights with your eyes closed. All you really see is blackness.
Yeah.
There's no shape. There's no form. There's not even a fuzzy image of anything. But if something moves toward you, you know what you're looking at, and you can describe it. For those of you who read my second book, the English title is Voyage Beyond Doubt,
yeah.
There's a description of a retrieval of a woman who died in the later stages of Alzheimer's. And as I wrote about the experience, I described it as that I saw an old woman. She was sitting in a wooden chair in a kitchen, and she was sitting next to a wooden kitchen table. The actual experience of that was that I didn't see any of those images, but I knew, in a visual sense, I knew that this elderly woman was sitting on a wooden chair next to a wooden table. I knew how she was dressed. I knew what her face looked like and could describe it. I knew that the look on her face told me that she hadn't had two thoughts you could call consecutive or in sequence in a very long time. Her thinking was completely fragmented. And indeed, when I described what I knew I saw but didn't really see to the person who asked me to check on the grandmother, it was all verified. It turned out that that it was her grandmother, and that she had, it was at that point that she had, I knew that she had died in the latter stages of Alzheimer's, and it turned out that sitting on that wooden kitchen chair next to the kitchen table was the only way that you could calm the woman down enough that she would sit quietly, and then you could feed her and whatever else she had to do. So sometimes the imagery, rarely, is just like the physical world, very intense, very clear, almost has light of its own, all the way through the other end of just seeing blackness, but knowing what you're looking at and describing it. And there are, I would say, there are also non-physical senses of hearing, smell, taste, touch, the same physical senses we have. But again, each of them have a much broader range of experience. So I expected I was going to hear people talking to me just like I am hearing you talking to me when I first began, and was very disappointed to discover that sometimes, rarely it was like that, sometimes it was more like I was hearing a voice in my mind, sometimes it was like I was talking to myself. It was difficult to know whether or not what I was doing was real or not, because the images and the sounds were not, they were not like the physical world. But I was able to gather information from the people I contacted and communicated that did verify that those experiences were real.
Yeah.
Now, the feelings of movement, I guess what I would say about feelings of movement is when I feel movement, it feels pretty much like it does here. If you were sitting in a car, that was driving on an extremely smooth road, so there were no bumps, and asked the driver to accelerate and had your eyes closed, you would feel that feeling of accelerating.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get up to speed and the car is no longer accelerating, then there's no longer a sensation of movement.
Mm.
The early in my explorations, when I intended to go from one place to another, I always had a sensation of speed, the sensation of movement. And I discovered as I continued to explore that I no longer had the sensation of movement, and it became more like, well, I'm going to intend, instead of being where I am here, I'm going to intend to be in a different place.
Hmm.
And it became a situation where as soon as I placed my intent to be in a different place, it was like somebody flipped a switch and I just went from one place to the other without moving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a feature it would be nice to have in the physical world.
Yes. I just recently took a vacation to Vermont. I spent like 3.5 hours in airplanes and at least that many hours or more sitting on the ground waiting for airplanes. It would have been much nicer just to say, I want to be in Vermont in the cabin of my friend across from Lake Champlain and just sort of close my eyes, open them and be there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Well, it's probably good to know how you experience things, because I think a lot of people are frustrated with trying these things and they don't think they can make them work because they don't know that that's what they're doing.
Yes, so exactly.
It's good to hear that even someone as experienced as you still sees things.
And I certainly started out being the kind of person who was extremely frustrated.
Yeah.
And I went beyond frustrated to angry because I just couldn't do it. I kept trying and trying and couldn't do it until I discovered I've been doing it all along. It just wasn't in the way that I expected.
Mm.
Yeah. Don't be afraid to use your imagination.
Yeah, that's the clue.
Yep. So is there more for that
question? No, but I have one last question.
Okay.
Also from Stina.
Uh-huh.
And that's...
Say hi to her.
I will. And she told me to say hi to you, by the way.
Uh-huh.
She wants to know your opinion of scientists that are experimenting with making remaking the Big Bang.
Ah.
If you've heard about that, you know, they're trying to make a model of it or trying to recreate it or...
Yeah.
Isn't it dangerous to mess with those forces, she asks.
Well,
if you know anything about that.
It would be if the Big Bang had actually happened. But I'm the kind of person who's more than half convinced that the Big Bang theory is a myth.
Okay.
And that it's based on the misunderstanding of something called the red shift.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to talk about that just for a moment before we... Well, it won't be just a moment, you know me. early on, the Big Bang Theory came out of observations, astronomical observations. And in these observations, what they discovered was that the frequency of light coming from a specific gas, we'll say hydrogen, the frequency of light coming from hydrogen is a very specific, very stable frequency. It doesn't change much. And what the early observers saw was that the light coming from distant stars was not exactly what it should have been for hydrogen or helium or the others. And in fact, the light frequency was shifted a little bit toward the red end of the optical spectrum or the electromagnetic spectrum. And as they looked at stars completely surrounding the Earth in a sort of 360-degree spherical field that they could observe, they found that every single star they observed had the same red shift. And the only way that they could explain this was by something called a Doppler effect, which, without going into a long explanation, if something is moving away from you, then its frequency is reduced, or if it's something light, like a star, if the light frequency is shifted toward the red, the Doppler effect says that indicates the star is moving away from you.
Mm-hmm.
If it had shifted toward the blue end of the spectrum, that would have indicated that star moving toward us.
Okay.
But in the early observations, what they found was that every single star they looked at, no matter which direction they looked at from Earth, was shifted toward the red end, indicating that every single star in the universe that they could observe was moving away from the Earth, and the Earth appeared to be the center of where it was moving from, since they were all moving away from the observer on Earth. The logical conclusion is the universe is expanding because it's moving away from us. Everything shifted to the red. And the Earth is at the center of that expansion. Now, most of us are aware that some other highly regarded authorities in this discussion, namely the Church, hundreds of years ago, used to tell us that the planet Earth was the center of God's universe. And everybody believed that until people like Copernicus and Bruno and a few other scientists began to actually observe the stars, and they concluded that, no, the universe does not revolve around the Earth. The Earth is not the center of the universe. In fact, the sun appears to be something that we're revolving around. Mm-hmm. So the sun maybe is the center of the universe or some other place. And in fact, those early scientists were threatened with being burned at the stake for such heresy as to suggest that the Earth is not the center of God's universe. Well, when scientists came back with the observations and the conclusion that the redshift indicates that the Earth is at the center of the universe, I got suspicious. Because I just don't believe we're quite that important to the universe. And so I began to do some research on my own, and I discovered that there's one other conceivable explanation for the universe, or for the red shift. And it's something that we see often here on the Earth. As when the sun first comes up, the light from the sun is shifted a little toward the red. So sometimes at a sunrise, as the sun is just beginning to come up over the horizon, the sun looks a little more yellow. The light around it looks a little more reddish. And as the sun gets straight up overhead, those reddish hues go away. The sun looks a little whiter.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the sun goes down, we again see the light from the sun shift toward the red end of the electromagnetic spectrum. And the reason it does that is because the light is at sunrise, the light is coming through a certain distance of Earth's atmosphere. And the amount of atmosphere between your observation point and the sun, the amount of atmosphere is much longer than it is if it's straight overhead at noon. And so what physicists will tell you about the redshift for sunlight is that Well, this happens because the sunlight is passing through the atmosphere, and as it does that, it gives up some of its energy to the atmosphere, and that causes the light from the sun to shift to the red. Well, if there were something that filled the entire universe, the old guys used to call it the ether. Now some people call it zero-point energy. There's a whole bunch of euphemistic names for it. But if the sun is filled with some sort of very, very, very fine something, we almost matter, then the redshift of the stars moving away from the Earth is explained by that sun or those starlight coming through whatever this sort of universal atmosphere is. And one of the key pieces of information that I find to be confirming of that theory is that one of the other things that scientists originally believed from their Doppler effect explanation, they discovered that the farther away a star is, the faster it was moving away from us, judging by the amount of redshift. So there was a direct correlation between the distance from Earth to the star. The greater the distance, the more redshift. The lower the distance, the less redshift. Just like the sun from an observer on the Earth at sunrise and sunset and noon. So anyway, it's just a, I would say, well, if the Big Bang actually happened, and I personally don't believe it did, and I have an experiment I just love. I mean, if you have somebody in your audience who is a physicist or someone who is a grad student who has access to the proper equipment, I'd like to talk to them. You just give them my name, and we'll talk about an experiment that could be run that was already run in Pasadena, California, by Albert Michelson back in the early 1930s. There's already been an experiment run that indicates that the Big Bang theory is a myth. So now I can finally come back to your original question. Isn't it dangerous to mess with these forces? Well, I don't know if it's dangerous or not. I think what she's referring to is the giant collider they built at CERN, where they're attempting to run experiments to, to sort of replicate what would have happened at the Big Bang. They're working with tremendously high physical world energy levels, and I don't know if it's dangerous or not. Yeah, we here in the States, there's a legend about some experiments done during World War II in which a ship rigged with some huge magnetic coils and in an experiment to try to make it invisible to radar. There's a legend that that ship disappeared during the first test, and that it reappeared somewhere else, some many miles away, and some of the crew members, when a ship then returned back to its original location, some of the crew members, according to the legend, were sort of stuck in the steel of the ship, almost as if while they were gone, they sort of drifted into the same area where the steel deck was, and when the ship returned to physical reality, they were stuck in that position. And I believe it was called the Philadelphia experiment. It's a legend. It probably did not really happen. But in the United States, UFOs never really happen. Even though they fly over the city of Phoenix and are observed by hundreds of thousands of observers who watch this thing that's so big they can't see both ends of it, and it's just like a couple hundred yards up off the ground. It's absolutely silent. It blocks out the stars, and it slowly moves for hundreds and hundreds of miles to the state of Arizona, flies right over Phoenix. And if you talk to anybody in this country about that who's connected with the military or the government, they will quickly explain to you that that didn't happen. And any of these other UFO things that people talk about didn't happen either. They were swamp gas, or they were the lights of flares, or...
Well, most of the time there are explanations for...
Yeah.
These things that people see, but
yes,
pretty sure that
And in fact, I just saw a documentary a couple of weeks ago. I think the documentary's title was "I Know What I Saw," and in that documentary, there are a number of people. One of them is a former minister from in the French government, who managed to get all of their UFO files released into the public domain. And he said sort of the same thing you did. There are a lot of these that can be explained by normal things that are just someone's observed and hasn't understood what they're looking at. But he said there's a certain percentage of them that are completely unexplainable. There are some of those files, as I understand it, being made public knowledge in Great Britain.
Okay.
But here in the States, those things never happen.
Nope.
speaking of UFOs, just a short sidelight. The people I call UFO drivers, the little guys who are sitting in this or inside the thing flying these around, they evidently have some reason not to make themselves visible in the physical world at times. And I say that because I was at a Monroe Institute program a number of years ago, and it's one called Starline. It was put together by Francine King. It is an excellent, excellent program. And one evening during the program, there were a bunch of us standing up on a deck that's on top of the building, so you have a clear view of the sky out in the country with no city lights in the way. And people were looking for UFOs. You know, they wanted to see a UFO, and they're up there mentally calling UFOs to come, and they're trying to get UFOs to show up. And somebody walked over to me and said, "Well, you know, Bruce, do you sense any UFOs around?" And so I closed my eyes and kind of relaxed and got a strong impression of three of them, and they were all small ones. And I got a sense of where they were located and communicated with one of the drivers of the UFO and asked him if he could make himself visible, you know, so we could see him. And he said, "Well," he said, "here in Virginia, we're way too close to some American military bases. And we know from experience that if we shift into physical reality, then we're going to show up on your radar. In a very short time, there are going to be some big, fast American Air Force fighter jets flying into this area. And we're going to have to get out of here." So I relayed that and thought to myself, I don't know if it's true or not, but that was my perception. Well, about 15 minutes later, Francine King, the one who was the leader of this particular program, came up on the roof, and the same person walked over and said, "Well, Francine, do you sense any UFOs around here?" And she stood there for a second, and then she pointed at the one where the guy I've been talking to, she pointed right at where he was, and she said, "Yeah, there's one over here, and there's one person in that one." And then she pointed at the second place I pointed at, and she said, "There's another one over there. He's a little bit further away, but it's just one person in that one." And then she pointed at the third place that I had pointed out, said, and there's another one right over there, a little further away than the other two, but just kind of hovering above the trees. And so I thought, overhearing that, I thought, well, either Francine and I are both crazy and making this up, or they're there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what?
I thought it was interesting that the UFO drivers were concerned about American Air Force fighter planes.
Mm-hmm. I'm always wondering what they're doing here, because I actually just made a little video where I talk about UFOs, and the funny thing about people who see them or read about them are always sure that there's someone in there who has a message for us, and that's why they're here. And I'm like, well, couldn't they just be passing through, you know, like, just they're going somewhere and just happen to pass Earth?
But, you kind of think of it, you know, just happen to be passing, you know, passing through from Alpha Centauri to some star system 500 billion, you know, million light years further on, and one of them turned to the other saying, you know, I heard this Earth place is kind of interesting. Yeah. How about if we swoop down there and just kind of cruise around a while and take a look?
Why not?
Why not? You know, it's a long drive. We'll just, you know, take a little side trip.
Well, it might just take seconds for them. So.
Yeah.
Do you have any impression of that? If they're really someone who's trying to make contact, or it's kind of accidental when it happens?
Oh, yeah. My opinion is that sometimes these contacts are fully intended, sometimes these contacts are fully intended by the aliens who come to make contact, and there seem to be a number of different reasons why they make these contacts. Some of them appear to be contacts in which they're trying to learn more about humans and what we do and how we think and what we, they're just, you know, it's kind of like somebody who's gone off into the African jungle and discovered a new kind of monkey, and they'd like to observe it for a while to see what it does, you know, what it eats. You know, some seem to be that way. Some seem to be making contact in response to a human who has asked for contact. Because there are some of us humans who, I suppose, are sort of curious about it place our intent that we have some contact. And I think that at times, these aliens sort of say, well, we've got a person over here who really wants to make contact with us, and so let's go over and see what we can do.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of people who report taking rides in such spacecraft and coming back home and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
I know, well, when I say I know, I really should say in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But from my experience, I would say that there are some who are definitely here observing, kind of like the ones I called Second Gath Group.
Mm.
They're definitely here observing, trying to learn and understand more about not just human life, but other life forms that exist in this reality that we call physical, to understand more about how we function and why we do the things we do.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's some of these have been a pretty wild ride.
Yeah.
Yeah. And going back to places like CERN, and are they doing, you know, playing with something dangerous? Well, I don't really know.
Time will tell.
I don't really know.
No. Well, that was actually our last question.
Our last question.
Yeah.
Well.
Certainly. Well, covered a great deal of.
Yeah. Well, and if you have more of me you'd like to do at some point, I'd be happy to.
I thought perhaps if I write in my I'm making a blog post where I put this little file inside.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about perhaps if people listen to this and they have additional questions, maybe, and you know, maybe some of the things you say make them curious to know other things, and then perhaps if they write their questions, we could do another talk.
Sounds like a great idea to me.
Me too.
Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure chatting with you, Anya.
You too, Bruce. Thank you so much for taking your time to do that.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sticking with it and nailing me down to get it done.
Yeah, it took a while.
that's a little bit of work, I know.
Yeah. Good.
Well, okay. Well, I'll sign off for now and chat with you again next time.
Yep. Have a great day.
You too. Love you, and I'll talk to you later.
Love you too.
Bye. Bye.